From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Did you ever wake up in the morning with a strange sensation that you've suddenly, miraculously been transformed into a giant cockroach? Unless you're Gregor Samsa, the character from Franz Kafka's classic story, The Metamorphosis, the answer is probably a definite no. But according to advertising executive Jonathan Bond, we do have something in common with this common household pest.
Consumers are like roaches. You know how roaches are always, they're always adapting to this new bug spray. You have to keep spraying them with more and more powerful stuff to make it work.
And Jonathan Bond's not talking about spraying consumers with DDT. He's talking about under-the-radar advertising techniques, innovative ways to attract the attention of today's cynical consumers, consumers who are tired of seeing advertising everywhere, on the internet, on people's clothing, even at the movies. Public radio is one of the few places where you're safe from advertising, but is it only a matter of time till you'll have to endure commercials here as well? We'll be back with our first story right after this commercial message.
Happy cows make happy meat, the kind of cows we love to eat. And we use every bit but the feet. We pour on the spice and they start to taste nice. But make sure you ask for well done. We have won, you're all done, you're all done. At Bun and Run, tastes like meat but much more fun.
All of the various animals that go into our prize burgers are raised on our beautiful 400-acre ranch in historic Appalachia. Once they seem dead, within weeks they're quick frozen and shipped indirectly to our distributors. After that, they're on their own, and so are you, at Bun and Run, where food is a four-letter word. Some assembly required.
Martin Mull with his advertising jingle parody, Bun and Run. Welcome back to the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. Jonathan Bond is the co-chairman and co-founder of Kirschenbaum Bond and Partners, an advertising agency in New York City. He and his partner, Richard Kirschenbaum, have written a book about the innovative techniques they use to get past our ad detectors. It's called Under the Radar, Talking to Today's Cynical Consumer. From the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City, Jonathan Bond tells Ann Strainchamps what he means by under-the-radar advertising.
You have to start with the premise, which is that consumers are very, very cynical and disbelieve advertising, and that if you just take a very overt approach and say, hey, this product's really good, buy it, it's not going to work.
Can you give me an example?
People already know when they see an ad that you're trying to sell them. So they're not really open. It's not as if they're just meeting a person and their person is saying, hey, this is a really great car or something, you ought to buy it, because they know you have a vested interest. So you already start out behind the eight ball. So you have to overcome that, and you have to do something that kind of slips through their defenses, which they've built up, because the average person is exposed to 1,500 commercial messages per day. And if they let all of those messages slip through their radar and paid attention to them, then they'd basically that's what they'd be doing all day.
So what does it take to slip through the radar?
Well, there's dozens of ways to get around that. And each situation is completely different. I mean, there's some general rules, and then there's some specifics that come up situation by situation. But I find that a great way to look at advertising, if you're a novice, is just to imagine, to take what you know about people and imagine brands as people and how they talk to you. You wouldn't like somebody that was a braggart if they walked into a bar and said, hey, aren't I fantastic? You want to end up thinking they're fantastic, but you don't want to do it by having them overtly come out and say it. So therefore, a brand that comes out and says, hey, I'm great, I'm number one, we sold the most cars of anyone, we're the best, you have the same reaction as you'd have to a person. oh, yeah, sure, you know, it's not very likable. So the idea is to demonstrate things, not say them overtly.
What was the first under-the-radar ad campaign that you came up with?
Okay, the first thing that we ever did was that Richard and I were working at other agencies, and we were doing some freelance work, and we met Kenneth Cole when he had about $2 million in sales. And he's, you know, very trendy, fashion-forward designer. And
this is Kenneth Cole, the shoe designer.
Yeah. Now he makes all kinds of things. Now he's got a $500 million business, and he's still running the same campaign that we created in 1986. But this was, at this point, he had almost no business, and he had very little money. And we realized that to make him, you know, very cool was easy, but that the problem with guys like him is they go out of style, they become faddish. And we thought, how can we put a campaign in place that will make sure that he's always in style? And so we came up with the idea of current events because they're always current. So we waited for an event to happen. Then we basically wrote, you know, a point of view from a quote from him. And that was the ad. It was Kenneth's view on a current event. So we could have done an ad this week on the election, obviously, on the election votes or something. But the first ad we did was Imelda Marcos bought 2,700 pairs of shoes. She could have at least had the courtesy to buy a pair of ours, signed Kenneth Cole, which, again, is self-deprecating. And it got picked up in the news, and everyone was talking about it. And we did a series of ads, you know, on all different kinds of current events. And he runs that campaign to this day.
And so was it successful? I mean, did he actually sell more shoes?
Yeah, but a lot of times advertising can sell. Some of the most effective advertising sells, but in a delayed fashion. So believe it or not, selling, you know, more product the day the ad runs isn't always the objective, which I know sounds complicated. But in other words, if you want to sell shoes on that day, you do a catalog, lots of page, a page with a lot of shoes, and you say, here they are, here's the prices. You see one you like, you buy it. That's kind of situational. But if you really want to have a brand long term, then they have to buy into the idea of the brand. Then you have to sell a point of view, a philosophy. And then long term, you're able to sell a lot more things because you've basically you've given the people something to buy into, something to believe in, almost like a religion.
So tell me about some of the other under the radar ad campaigns you've created. What have been some of your favorites?
Oh, Snapple, I think. The Snapple lady. And we did a whole lot of tactics that were revolutionary at that time. First of all, using Wendy the Snapple lady, who is, you know, from Long Island, 5 feet tall and over 200 pounds, as a spokesperson for a natural new age beverage was kind of controversial. No one had ever done that before. And no one wanted to do it. And then I remember we showed a picture of, I think it was Oprah and Roseanne and maybe Rosie O'Donnell, somebody like that. And we said, here are the most popular women in America today. And they were all overweight. And this is the truth. This is, you know, what the country is. And so having somebody like that really demonstrates that we're honest, we're who we are, we're natural, we're not putting hype on it. And the whole idea was 100% natural marketing. It was marketing that doesn't feel like it was created by an ad agency. It feels like a couple of guys brewing up Snapple in their attic and making their own ads. So you have to work very hard to look at, make it look like you're making your own ads and yet still have them be good.
Was that the one where you even went ahead and aired ads that you'd sort of tried to do and had kind of failed, and you went ahead and aired those anyway?
Yeah, I mean, I think we took it to more of an extreme than you really had to. You know, it was like if a tree falls and nobody hears it, did it really fall? You know, we really did everything exactly the way the shoot happened. We had no scripts when we did TV shoots, and we ran whatever happened. And, you know, we could have had this argument, it doesn't matter if it happened or not, as long as it looks like it's real. But we went all the way to actually, someone would write a letter, like a guy from a colonel from Kentucky wrote a letter saying he hated New York, but he liked Snapple. So we didn't have a script. Again, there was never a script. We always just had a situation we put together, and we'd run the camera and we'd run whatever happened. 100% natural marketing. We sent Ed Koch out to convince him that New York was a great place. And the colonel was named Ed, and, you know, they were drinking Snapple and saying, to the Eds, and it was just great. And we ran this whole spot, and at the end he says, I still don't like New York, but I like Snapple and I like you, Ed. It was great. It's a fantastic spot. And it was all true.
What about, there was something else with Snapple, Shane the Wonder Dog?
Yeah, a woman wrote a letter saying that she had a dog who loved Snapple, and all he had to do was hear the bottle being opened. It made a snap sound, and the dog would come running. So we went out there with the camera. It cost like $200,000 to do this. And we sat all day, and she opened like 4,000 bottles of Snapple, and the dog just sat there, never moved.
And, and anybody else
ran this
said,
commercial.
Forget it. But
we read the letter. She said, this is Shane the Wonder Dog, we called him. And we put the camera on the dog, and she's doing everything to get him to come. And he sat there the entire time, and that was the commercial. Which actually, it made the point that Snapple is 100% natural. We're not really, quote, so good at marketing and advertising. We don't really know how to do a good commercial or a slick commercial. And so we'll run whatever happened, even if it's, quote, a failure. Coke never would have done that, or Pepsi never would have done that.
One of my favorites of the ads you did, I really love the bamboo lingerie one, because that would have completely gotten me.
Right, yeah, we did stencils for a lingerie company on the street, and it said, from here it looks like you could use some new underwear, bamboo lingerie. And those were great, because from a media standpoint, another thing that makes something an under-the-radar idea is using media. Because everyone knows when they turn on the TV or when they open a magazine, they have the radar up because they know they're about to encounter many commercial messages. So they're prepared. And the surprise attack works because if you're walking down the street, you don't have your, you know, ad editor up. So when you look down the street and you see this, you know, these words looking at you, you read them. And then you smile and you go, that's interesting. Maybe that's an interesting brand. And I should go check it out.
Maybe I do need some new underwear.
Maybe I do need some new underwear. Yes, exactly.
So what other surprise, unusual places have you put ads?
Well, Snapple, we did advertising on mangoes to introduce Mango Madness. It said now available in Snapple. So we actually stickered 22 million pieces of fruit in South America.
Now, by now, you're not the only ones who use the under-the-radar technique. I figure you've probably got a few favorites of that other people have come up with?
Yeah, there was a commercial, basically. I think the assignment the agency was given was there was a special low, low weekend fare, what a surprise, to the U.S. that weekend. And they had to basically do an ad, your typical sales ad. And they came up with an ingenious way of doing it, which was they hired actresses, I think it was, to go to all the movie theaters because you can run a lot of commercials before movies in the U.K., and a couple gets on TV, and they're having a wonderful time together, and they're in Central Park or something, and all of a sudden, the couple's kissing, and the man looks at the corner of his eye at the audience, and a woman stands up and says, "Nigel, is that you? What are you doing there?" And a huge dialogue ensues, which is, of course, perfectly timed. And, you know, the woman in the audience is having a dialogue right on cue with the guy in the commercial. And it seems that she's on screen. Yeah. And it seems that, you know, she's his girlfriend and he's seeing her with this other woman. And you know, the reason that he's with her is because he got this low, low fare to the States. And that's where he stashed this other woman. It's very funny. And then in the end, she walks out in a huff and dumps him. And the whole audience stands up and claps. It's fantastic.
Do you have any others that are particular favorites that either that you've done or that others that you really wish you had done?
Yeah, I have one other that I wish I'd done, which was I think the BMW Z3 when it was introduced. And they basically introduced the car by putting it in the James Bond movie and replacing the Aston Martin. And they paid money to replace the Aston Martin with the BMW Z3. I thought that was just cool.
That's an example of product placement, which has been going on for a long time in movies. I think Reese's Pieces was in E.T.,
yeah,
for example. You created another example, product placement in a play, which is a little hard to believe.
The play is actually not the better example of that, but I'll tell you the one that was really cool. We helped create this drink called the Hennessy Martini, which is a cocktail using one of our clients, Hennessy Cognac. And to help stimulate demand and teach bartenders how to make it at exactly the same time, we actually had live commercials, but people didn't know there were commercials. In bars, we had really good-looking types of people, out-of-work actors and that sort of thing, go into the hot bars in the right cities, and they would carry on and have conversations and maybe get into a fight and that sort of thing and make up, and they'd end up buying everyone a round of these Hennessy martinis. So the bartenders would learn how to make it. The people there would see a really good-looking, charming couple drinking it, think it must be cool, and no one knew that they were actually really ads.
That's so under the radar. That's so under the radar. It seems unethical somehow. Like how, you wouldn't even know it was an ad.
Yeah, no, it's on the borderline. I have to. It is on the borderline. But I don't think there's any harm. Hey, you're getting people free drinks. It's all in good fun. Okay. And then one of the people eventually told a journalist, and it was reported, and on CNN and in I think Esquire did a whole story on it. Forbes did a story on it, and then we stopped doing it because it was not under the radar anymore. Huh. People knew. It doesn't work. Once you know they're paid, it doesn't work. So we had to abandon that after 4 or 5 years.
Jonathan Bond is the co-author of Under the Radar, talking to today's cynical consumer. He spoke to Anne Strainchamps from the Museum of Television and Radio in New York City. We've been talking about under-the-radar advertising, but there's another kind of advertising that we could call under-the-ground. It involves the use of dead celebrities as pitchmen and pitchwomen in television commercials. Through the wonders of digital technology, the late John Wayne helps sell Coors Light beer, and Jackie Gleason hawks Braun hand blenders. Here's the Canadian comedy troupe Radio Free Vestibule with their take on under-the-ground advertising.
Laurence Olivier for Diet Coke.
Hello. I'm Laurence Olivier. I've been dead for over 2 years.
Now.
But through the marvelous technology of tape editing,
I'm able to
speak to you from beyond the grave. What you are listening to right now was made by cutting
together
things I said in my many films and interviews. Although I never would have endorsed
a product
like this
when I was
alive,
my estate
has determined
that if I was
alive,
I would really want to tell you
how much I enjoy the
taste of
Diet Coca-Cola.
I think Diet
Coca-Cola is really excellent,
dude.
It's awesome. I wish I could
have some
now,
but I can't
because
I'm
dead.
But
take it from me,
Laurence Olivier.
Maketh thy
mouth
alive
with
Diet
Coca-Cola.
It's everything you want it to be.
Laurence Olivier for Diet Coke, brought to you by Radio Free Vestibule. Coming up, the father of the funny commercial, Stan Freberg. And we'll find out about the culture jamming movement. Plus, the fine art of using music to sell products. And remember, you're under no obligation to listen to the rest of the show, and no salesman will call. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Stan Freberg is one of America's best-loved humorists and satirists. His groundbreaking comedy records have sold millions of copies. Back in the mid-50s, he broke new ground in the advertising industry by introducing humor into commercials. In fact, Advertising Age magazine credits Stan Freberg as the father of the funny commercial. He told me how he got involved in advertising.
Out of a clear blue sky in 1956... a man in San Francisco, office of Cunningham and Walsh, named Howard Gossage, brilliant man, and he was a Freberg fan, and he had a client that was in trouble, Contadina tomato paste, so he liked the way I dealt with humor for the ear, is the way he put it. Yeah. I like the way you handle humor for the ear. So I said, yeah, I'm your man, but I hate advertising. He said, well, you're just my man then. So he allowed me to do anything I want, and wanted, past tense, Freberg. Anyhow, so the first radio commercial that I ever did was an immediate success and helped the Contadina tomato paste company pull out of a terrible slump they'd been put in by the giant Hunt's company. Hunt's tomato sauce had invaded their little tomato paste field.
Can you tell us what you did with the Contadina tomato paste that was different?
Well, yes. I created it the way I always wanted a commercial to sound, as though somehow I had tapped in with some listening device a normal conversation between two people, except these two people were talking on top of the Empire State Building.
Now, look, you got it straight, what we want?
Yeah, I think so. Mm-hmm. You want me to take off the tower from the Empire State Building and
That's
put
right.
a 300-foot can of Contadina tomato paste up there.
That's right, in full color.
Now, look, mister, are you sure this is all right? Did you check with the Empire State Building people?
Oh, they won't know the difference. Somebody's always working on the building. You know
yeah, but that tower was put there to moor Zeppelins to.
Look, let's be realistic. How many Zeppelins have moored there in the last month?
Well, not many. But look, I don't know if I want to get...
You want us to...
No, I don't want to get involved.
Want us to get another contractor? Is that it?
No.
Is that it?
No, I like the job, but we could be arrested.
Well, suppose you let me worry about that, huh?
Okay, we'll start first thing in the morning.
Good. Now, don't forget to have the can blink in International Morse code. The words, there are many delicious uses for Contadina tomato paste.
You know, wait a minute. I thought you wanted it to blink 8 great tomatoes in that little bitty can.
Yeah, well...
Which do you want?
Let me sleep on it, okay?
Okay.
Who puts 8 great tomatoes in that little bitty can? Who puts 8 great tomatoes in that little bitty can? Who puts 8 great tomatoes in that little bitty can? You know who, you know who, you know who.
In case you don't, it's Contadina tomato paste.
I wondered why... Advertising had to be so unbearable and boring. Why couldn't it be as entertaining as anything people ever heard on the radio or television? So that's and the success, the immediate success of that Contadina campaign was so thrilling to me that I had secretly suspected that if you treated people as though they had a some degree of intelligence and that they would laugh at the same things that I laughed at, it would work at the point of sale, and it did. And so I became this wunderkind Freeberg, and so it launched me into a whole new career. But I didn't intend to stay in advertising quite as long as I did, believe me.
Yeah.
And shortly after that, I was approached by a man who owned a Chinese food company called Chun King, and his name was Gino Pelucci. And I thought, yes, a strange name for a man to be the head of a Chinese food company, but never mind.
We're going to listen to your Chun King chow mein commercial in just a moment.
Yes.
I'm curious in setting it up, though, to ask you about the truth in advertising part. It was you feel that was also one of your firsts, that not only were you going to laugh about the things you were promoting, but that you'd tell the truth about them.
Well, I felt as a satirist basically is a social critic, a critic of society, and who wants to see things changed for the better, hopefully. And so as a satirist, I thought, the FTC at that point was, Federal Trade Commission was running around nailing everybody from the Campbell Soup Company, who was charged with putting clear glass marbles in the bottom of their bowls of soup so the few scant vegetables would be forced up near the surface so they could photograph, look at this chock full of vegetable soup. See, anyhow, and the Libby Owens Ford Glass Company also was cited for putting out a glare-proof windshield, but when they went to shoot it in the studio, the glare-proof windshield picked up quite a glare from the lights in the studio. So they just removed the windshield altogether, right? So now there's an announcer pointing to the windshield. See? No glare. I'll bet no glare.
Kind of a sad reflection, isn't it?
Yes. And so that was going on left and right. So I reasoned that anybody who came along and told the truth and pointed out the deception in a lot of advertising would shine like a beacon of light. So that's when I discovered that the Chun King Company had only 5% of the market in America, and that left 95% that had never heard of it. So that's what I did in the first commercial.
There are a few people who haven't heard it yet, but that's about to be remedied. We're going to play it for you now.
All right. 95% it's called, yes.
95% of the people in the USA are buying Chunking Chow Mein.
Hold it, please. That's not exactly true. Only 5% of the people are buying it. 95% have never bought a single can.
You want us to say that?
Why not? Lay it on the line. Let's have a little truth in advertising for a change.
All right.
Correction, 95% of the people in the USA are not buying Chunking Chow Mein.
That's better.
It could be that they don't like the label.
Or simply think it isn't going to be very good. But should that 95% of the people ever try Chunking, they're going to eat Chunking Chow Mein for the rest of their life.
Wouldn't that get a little monotonous?
Okay.
For the rest of the week.
How about occasionally?
You want to add anything else?
Well, just a little soy sauce, maybe.
By the way, the president of the company whom I referred to earlier, Gino Pelucci, who still is a friend and a client, he said he hated it. He said, I'm not going to put that on the air. I said, fine. He said, I want you to redo it. I said, no, I'm not going to do that, sir. He said, why not? I said, because that's my best shot. If you don't like that, you won't like anything that I do. He said, really? I said, really? He said, all right, let me go back and listen to it again. Now I hear him walk across the floor in Duluth, Minnesota, and play it one more time. He came back to the phone and said, it wasn't so bad the second time around. So anyhow, he put it on there. He said, if that stuff works, if that commercial works, I'll pull you in a Chinese rickshaw up La Cienega Boulevard in Los Angeles. So
Was it a hard pull for him?
Yes, it was. But nevertheless, I have a picture in my book. It only hurts when I laugh. And it's a famous picture in advertising of a client paying off a bet. When the sales went up and hit 40% increase, 40% up, he came out with a photographer, I noticed, rented a rickshaw and said, get in. And so anyhow.
Satirist Stan Freberg, talking about his advertising career. There is a new box set collection of some of Stan Freberg's best advertising and non-advertising work called Tip of the Freberg. Negative Land is an experimental music and art collective from Berkeley, California. The group uses audio samples from radio, TV, and even cell phone calls to create collage compositions that serve as critiques of various aspects of modern life. In 1984, Negative Land coined the term culture jamming to describe their unique form of media activism. One of the group's targets is advertising. On their 1997 album, Dis Pepsi, Negative Land attacked the advertising efforts of Pepsi Cola. From the Dis Pepsi album, here's Negative Land with Drink It Up.
When 7-Up has got me down, when high C gets me low, my Lovat's blue ain't blue, it's brown. My Nestle's quick just makes me slow. When my sparkling cider's lost its shine, my can of Sharps is dull. Hawaiian punch has knocked me cold, a feeling hits my skull.
And my mind just turns to Pepsi, and I couldn't tell you why. Smart drinks lead me to forget, and Coke won't get me high. When constant comment won't shut up, I'll sit right down.
Color Lesson is another culture jammer, part of the global network of media activists who are trying to launch a new social activism. Culture jammers are fighting back against the omnipresence of advertising in our consumer culture and the negative impact they feel that it's having on our lives. One of the major weapons in Color Lesson's culture jamming arsenal is his magazine, Adbusters. Adbusters features subvertising, parody ads that attack the advertising industry. For example, There's a series of ads that spoof the ads for Camel cigarettes, which featured a character called Joe Camel. In the Adbuster versions, Joe Camel is known as Joe Chemo. One ad shows Joe Chemo walking down a hospital corridor, wheeling his IV unit along with him. In another, Joe Chemo lies in an open coffin. Culler Lassen has also written a book about his philosophy. It's called Culture Jam, The Uncooling of America. He told Steve Paulson about a moment of truth that led to his career as a culture jammer.
I'd been going to this supermarket for a long, long time, and bit by bit they just started feeling oppressive there. And one day they had suddenly instituted this system where for me to get my cart, I had to put a coin into the cart and somehow disengage it from the line of carts. And then on the way out again, to get my quarter back, I had to play this little game that their efficiency experts were forcing down on me. And I remember just suddenly there was this kind of a rage that was starting to build in my gut, and I just decided to jam that coin right into the coin slot so nobody could use that cart anymore. I just remember doing that in a bit of a fit, and then just walking away and feeling suddenly quite liberated and quite wonderful about what I'd just done, which was probably illegal. But it was a liberating kind of a moment when I just realized that you don't have to swallow your rage, that I don't want to be the sort of guy who runs around all the time with a low-level rage inside me that I can't get out. And I decided that from then on I would, whenever I can, I would liberate myself.
It sounds like you're saying that sometimes people need to get angry. They need to snap and see where it goes.
Well, yeah, I think that we are living in really strange times, and many of us can't quite figure out what's going on. The way I see it, I think that there's a really big power grab going on right now, and that corporations are somehow taking over the food we eat, and they even go as far as giving us genetically engineered food and even refusing to label it. And they're also, of course, forcing a whole nutritional agenda on us all the time. We also live at a time when the mass media has largely been taken over by corporations. Half a dozen of them now control the really big ones like Disney and AOL, Time Warner, and three or four others. They now control over 50% of all the information and entertainment flows on the whole planet. And back in Seattle a year ago, I mean, they were trying to write the world trade rules. And I think in Seattle and since then, a lot of people have suddenly got fed up with this arrogance of corporations, and they see this big power grab for what it really is, a way of imposing a kind of a corporate plan on the whole planet. And a lot of people are giving vent now to this this rage that they feel within them.
On the dedication page of your book, you refer to Philip Morris Inc. as your mortal enemy.
Yes.
And you vow to take down this corporation. Yes. Were you serious about that?
Absolutely serious. Absolutely serious. I started smoking when I was in university in my late teens, and part of the reason that I did that was because of Philip Morris and their cowboy campaigns and the fact that I thought it was such a cool thing to do. And then it took me 30 years to kick the habit. And I have never quite forgiven Philip Morris for the role that they played in that 30 years of my life.
But, you know, everyone now knows that smoking is dangerous, know that smoking mm-hmm. causes cancer. Can you really blame a cigarette company anymore for that?
Well, no. I don't think it's a question of blaming the cigarette company for the fact that they sell cigarettes. I'm blaming Philip Morris for the way that they spent billions of dollars promoting this killer product of theirs. I think that they have a right to sell a product, a legal product like a cigarette, but I don't forgive them for the way that they recruited generation after generation of young people into this, what often turns out to be a lifetime of smoking.
Now, one trend that we've been seeing in recent years is that a lot of advertisers are creating ads that make fun of the fact that that these are ads. And I'm wondering if that's making your job harder.
Lately, there's been this trend to come up with ironic ads, you know, postmodern ads, ads that blithely, you know, make fun of themselves. And this is a technique they've discovered that works very well with young people, and they've been using it successfully. In fact, they have co-opted many of the culture jamming techniques into their own advertising. We're moving on. We're looking for you know, for the next round in this this war of nerves. In some way, I actually enjoy the game.
But doesn't this just reflect what everyone knows, and that's that the advertising that we see on TV is trying to sell us something?
Yeah, of course we all know that, but I think that that one thing that is really coming to the fore now, there is a realization that, especially among young people, that ever since they were a little baby, you know, crawling around the TV set, that they have somehow been propagandized, and that well-documented 3,000 marketing messages a day are seeping into their brain, and that somehow this has diminished them. And of course, we know that that psychological propaganda like that, or psychological violation, isn't quite the same as physical violation. But nonetheless, a lot of people feel that they are carrying psychological scars, and that it is this propaganda machine, the 3,000 marketing messages a day, that's doing it to them. And I predict that there's going to be, over the next 5-10 years, the rise of a mental environmental movement that will be every much as powerful and potent as the physical environmental movement was, you know, 10-20 years ago.
What would this mental environmental movement consist of? What would people do?
I think that they would, well, to put it bluntly, they would clean up the toxic areas of the mental environment. They would wake up to the fact that this is making them sick, and that they would just start taking back the mental commons.
What does that mean in practical terms?
Well, in practical terms, it means fighting for your right to get on television and have a free marketplace of ideas on television. It will also, I think, turn out to be very much a battle for cyberspace. Will the corporations be able to do the same thing to cyberspace as they did to television? It will be the formation of groups of media activists like Indie Media, who have their own websites and their own philosophies, and they're, you know, on a daily basis trying to take back control of the mental environment. And I think that underlying this mental environmental movement will be this realization by more and more people that media clutter, the kind of commercially saturated, violence-saturated, sexually saturated mental environment, that this is actually making us sick. And when people make that personal connection in their own personal lives, then I think finally this 50-year run that advertising has had will be over.
Kalle Lassen is the author of Culture Jam, The Uncooling of America. He spoke to Steve Paulson. If you'd like to get involved in culture jamming, you can join Kalle Lassen's social marketing campaigns, Buy Nothing Day and TV Turnoff Week.
Hello, this is Ricardo Montalban.
Corporations often spend millions of dollars to secure celebrity endorsements, but commercial campaigns can be wiped out overnight if a celebrity says the wrong thing or their image changes.
To just put a celebrity up there. Hello, this is Ricardo Montalban.
Hi, this is Marion Ross.
Hello, this is Ricardo Montalban.
See if you can identify this sound.
Hello, this is Ricardo Montalban.
That's the sound of me being hit by a tennis ball.
Hello, this is Ricardo Montalban.
Believe me, it hurts.
Hello, this is Ricardo Montalban. Hello, this is Ricardo Montalban.
A most successful formula.
Hello, this is Ricardo Montalban.
A most successful formula.
Hello, this is Ricardo Montalban. Hello, this is Ricardo Montalban. Hello, this is Ricardo.
The original Culture Jammers, Negative Land, with a most successful formula. Is there a most successful formula for writing an advertising jingle? Say, this jingle?
Wherever you are, reach for K2R and lift that spot. Clean out. K2R, K2R, K2R.
Thank you.
Raymond Scott wrote that jingle. According to him, writing a jingle is like writing a love letter. You must say it simply and with feeling. Next up, the not-so-simple art of selling through song. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Wally Williams is the chief executive officer of Tequila Mockingbird and Sound Design in Austin, Texas. He's created jingles and advertising music for such clients as Southwest Airlines and the Texas Lottery. He told Steve Paulson the musicians he works with don't always share his approach to writing advertising jingles.
I had a guy in my group one time when I worked at an ad agency. He was a young writer. He had a guitar up on his wall that he had broken, smashed to pieces, you know?
Mm-hmm.
And he had it stuck up on the wall, and then he had a little piece of typewritten paper under it that said, "I don't do jingles." And, you know, that was his statement. And my philosophy was, you don't have to, you know, call it a jingle. You can call it music, which is just another form of communication. And so that's when I said, regardless of what the trendy thinking was, I said, you know what, you can do music that delivers a message in a really clever way that's not corny and that is enlightening and is art, just like if you want to classify advertising as art, which sometimes I think it is.
So what's the art of making good commercial music, a good advertising song or piece of music?
I think that it has to be entertaining first. It has to be memorable. And it has to sell the product. A lot of creatives that I know in the business leave the last one off. You know, they say, well, if it sells the product, great. But what we really want to do is create a commercial that just entertains the hell out of people, you know?
I've had that experience a lot of times watching TV. I'm kind of riveted by that 30-second spot. But then after it's done, I'm wondering, so what was that for?
Yeah. Well, see, I think that consumers love to be sold. You know, to me, a commercial, to be a whole commercial, to be 100%, needs to entertain and then sell you in such a way that you enjoyed being sold because, you know, consumers aren't stupid. And they know that a commercial is there for a reason. They know what it's for. And most of the time, they're turned off because nobody wants to be sold on anything. If they get sold, though, and they get sold in an entertaining way, then they like the commercial even more. It's an interesting phenomenon, but it's... And that's why I think that commercials have sort of been elevated into an art form. It's just that their parameters are a little different than pure art, you know?
We're going to listen to one of the songs that your company produced. It's from a TV commercial for Nissan, and it's not an original song. It's actually the theme song from the old TV show Laverne and Shirley, performed by the man in black, Johnny Cash. Can you tell me the story behind this?
Yeah, we got a call from Chiat Day in L.A., and there was a creative director, Rob Silton, who had thought of the idea, and he had come up with several of the Nissan spots. This was part of the campaign, and it was one that the client was not even wanting to do. They said that's a pretty wild idea to have Johnny Cash in the plant singing the Laverne and Shirley theme song, but we'll give you a shot at doing a demo. So they called us, and we said, this is a great, great idea. Love the idea. So we called Dale Watson, who is a local, he's actually getting pretty national, international country singer, but he's based in Austin. And he's just the old-style country singer, the Merle Haggard and Johnny Cash world, although he's a young guy. And we asked him to come in and do the demo for us, and so he did, and we sent it off to him, and they actually sent it to Johnny, and Johnny listened to it and said, I thought that was me, you know.
I had no idea this is how it works. You actually have someone else perform it as if he's Johnny Cash, as if he's the guy you really want to do it,
And then you send out that
right.
to Johnny Cash himself.
But the reason you do that is because you have to see how it's going to contour in a 60-second time frame. And you know which part of the song you're going to use, or 60 or 30, because that's the length of most TV commercials. So you really have to, you know, show the agency that the song is going to start here and it's going to end here and it's going to fit into your time frame. And then they can take that. And what they did was they showed the demo to the client. That's my understanding. And the client, which was Nissan, said, okay, well, it's a go. Let's do it.
1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Give us any chance, we'll take it. Read us any rule, we'll break it. We're gonna make our dreams come true.
Doing it our way.
Nothing's gonna turn us back now. Straight ahead and on the track now. We're gonna make our dreams come true.
Doing it our way.
There's nothing we won't try. Never heard the word impossible. This time there's no stopping us.
We're gonna do it.
On your mark, get set and go now. Got a dream and we just know now. We're gonna make that dream come true. And we'll do it our way.
Yes, our way.
Make our dreams come true. We'll do it our way.
Yes, our way.
Make all our dreams come true. For me and you.
That song won a Gold Clio Award in 1998, didn't it?
Correct. That was a pretty big winner for us, and we got a lot of press out of it.
Because it was such an original idea, what makes that work?
I think it's the combination of elements. The creative director who thought that up was, he's a pretty big thinker, and he said, you know, this is a great idea. If you had Laverne and Shirley doing it, it wouldn't be as good. But if you put Johnny Cash in there, then it's something he would never do. So it's a sort of an unexpected approach. Of course, in Laverne and Shirley, it happens in the factory, I think, in the opening of the show. So the environment was the same. You know, in this case, it was a Nissan factory.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, I think, the unexpectedness of Johnny Cash doing that particular song.
We're going to listen to a really interesting spot, one that you wrote for the Texas Department of Transportation. It's called Blood and Guts. Can you tell me how you came up with this one?
Yeah, this is a pretty good story. I was with a friend of mine. We were coming from we'd been on a shoot, and we were coming back from the airport in the car, and he said, I've got to come up with a campaign for the PGA Tour. And he said, I don't know what to do. And I said, well, why don't you do a song? Everybody loves music. And that was always my solution, so we both laughed. And then I started, just for fun, singing, hole in one, hole in one, I'm going to get me a hole in one, just like all those boys on the PGA Tour. And we laughed, and then I called Tom's phone at his office and left it on his voicemail. And he started playing that for everybody at his ad agency, GSD&M. So we all got a big joke out of it and kind of sang that for a couple of weeks. And then they were pitching an account, MasterCard. So we all started singing, MasterCard, MasterCard. And kind of so it was just a running joke, right? Then one day I got a call from a guy over there who said, we've got a little commercial here that nobody wants to do. Would you like to take a shot at it? And I said, sure. And he sent it over to me, and I looked at it and kind of started just playing. And the first thing I wrote was, blood and guts, blood and guts. And I'll let you hear the rest of it. But that's how that came about. And it just goes to show that the creative process is pretty hard to define. You never know how anything's going to happen.
Well, let's listen to this spot.
Blood and guts, your broken body full of cuts, lying there beside the interstate. Brain matter, feel it ooze out, see it splatter. Sirens coming, but they're coming late. Broken limbs, your friends and family singing hymns, talking about the hand that you were dealt. Broken-hearted, dear departed, it could all have been avoided if you'd buckled up your safety belt.
Sponsored by the Texas Department of Transportation.
That takes me back. That takes me back to my high school driver's ed classes. Those films that you used to see.
Yeah, they were. They said, you know, it's really hard to break through to the people. Their particular audience is young men in their late teens, and these guys have seen and heard everything, you know, with rap music or whatever, and so it's hard to shock them.
How did the Texas Department of Transportation react to this when they first heard it?
I think they loved it because they had been struggling with the same problem, which was everybody, you know, trying to write something that cuts through the clutter and not having that much success because it's really hard to cut through that type of clutter. And they liked it so much that it happened to be 45 seconds long. And most radio commercials are 30 and 60. And they just said, you know what? We don't want you to change a thing on this. In fact, we'll change our media buy and make people run 45-second spots. So that's the way they sent it out. I've never had a client that believed in something that strongly to do something like that.
Advertising music composer Wally Williams. He talked with Steve Paulson. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you want a cassette copy of this hour, please call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for the program Advertising Here, There, and Everywhere, number 1217A. If you have questions or comments on the show, you can write to us at To the Best of Our Knowledge, 821 University Avenue, Madison, Wisconsin, 53706. Or send us email through our website at www.wpr.org/book.
PRI, Public Radio International.
Double-crossing dames, grifters on the make, and sleazy dive bars. Dead men that are heavier than broken hearts. Some think his novels are just pulp fiction, but to others, Raymond Chandler is one of the greatest American writers of the 20th century. Next week on To the Best of Our Knowledge, the literary world of Raymond Chandler. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International.